Okay, so I wanted, because next week we're starting Parashat Shmot, crazy as that is, we're starting Parashat Shmot, and I sort of skipped over this part of the Agadata last week. I want to focus on this part of the Agadata. So if you remember, let's remind ourselves where we were last week. So remember, last week, what did we talk about? Last week, we talked about David HaMelech's alarm clock. Remember? Right? And the Gemara, in the middle of that, right, we skipped. What did we do in that Gemara? We basically read the Gemara from the vantage point of David HaMelech, right? But if you remember, there were other characters that ended up in that Gemara. So at one point in the Gemara has this very bizarre comment. And the Gemara says, wait, how did David HaMelech know when it was midnight? How could the David Mihaveyada Palga Delil Yaimat? How did David HaMelech know when it was midnight? Why shouldn't David HaMelech know when it's midnight? So the Gemara says, the question. The Gemara says, Hashta Moshe Rabbeinu Lave Yada. Moshe didn't know midnight. Dichtiv kachatzot alayla ni yotzei bitoch mitzrayim. Because he said, kachatzot. Now, I want you to understand that this is a very bizarre read of the Gemara, of the Pasuk rather. Right? What does that mean? Kachatzot alayla. So the way the Gemara is reading Kachatzot is
around,
right? Here's the problem. Whenever you have a chaf anywhere, right, it can be one of two types of chaf. One is what's called a kaf hash dimyon, the comparative chaf. And the other is the kaf ha shivyon, the chaf of equivalence, right? So Kachatzot halayla could mean at midnight, around midnight. Exactly. So Chazal are taking it to mean about midnight. Let's take Chazal at their word for the moment here, okay? About midnight, I will go out. So the Gemara says, my Kachatzot, what is around midnight? Remember, it's God talking. Ilema damar leikud shabrichu Kachatzot. If God was the one who said about midnight, mi ika sepuke k'may shmaya, does God have doubt? Right? You know, I'll give, whatever. Well, yeah, 1 second, that's the next line. I said bring the Gemara, right? The Gemara that says, Ella, you're right. Ella damar bachatso. God said at midnight. Va'ata iu v'amar kachatso. And Moshe said, about midnight, Alma Misafkale, which shows you that Moshe didn't know when midnight was, right? This Gimel Amud Bet, right? So Alma Misafkale, but David have a yada. So the Gemara's first answer is, you're right. Moshe doesn't know when midnight is, but David does. Why does David know? Because he has an alarm clock, and that was what we did last week, right? But the Gemara, now if you skip to Dalet Amud Aleph, Rabbi Zera comes in and he says, no, Moshe la'olam aveyada, v'David nami aveyada. Moshe didn't know what time midnight was, and so did David. So the Gemara says, v'chev ni David aveyada kinor lamalei. Right? So then the Gemara said, but wait a second. If David knew, then why did he need an alarm? Liture mishnate, as an alarm to wake him up. Meaning he might have known what time it is, but you know, he was sleeping.
You can't just decide to wake up.
Exactly. But then the Gemara says, v'chevin the Moshe avayada, but if Moshe knew it was midnight, lama leil memra kachatzot, then why did he say around midnight? So the Gemara then says something shocking. Moshe kasavar, shema yit'u itztagnine paro. Maybe
The astrologers
will think that it's 11:59 or 12:01, Rechman Alitzlan, and they will say, V'yomru Moshe Badoyu, and they'll say, Moshe's a liar.
Assuming that they aren't firstborn.
What?
Assuming that they aren't firstborn.
Right. Da'amar mar, lamed l'shanka, lamar niyodeya. And from here you learn, always say, I'm not sure, I don't know. Shema yititpadev v'te'achez, because maybe you'll be caught in a lie. Okay? This is the line I want to focus on. Because the Gemara here says something wild. right? If you tease out what the Gemara is saying here, what is the Gemara saying? That, let's say, right, this is how the Gemara conceives of Mitzrayim. That let's say God sends it, right, goes out at midnight and kills all the firstborns and no one but the firstborns. Okay? But the astrologers say, oh, according to our calculations, it was a lift at 11:59 and 30 seconds. They will say, you know what? It's a fluke. It's a fluke. Moshe's a liar. This is all meaningless. They won't say, you know what? Maybe our clock was off by 30 seconds. They'll say, no, it's a fluke. I don't know why every firstborn and only the firstborns died. I don't know. I don't know. Right? So Moshe had to say it'll be about midnight, because this way, if they said it's 11:59 and 30 seconds, taka, Moshe's right that about midnight people's going to die.
They're going to say maybe this God isn't perfect.
Oh, okay. So let's figure out. Meaning, the problem is here that this seems crazy. Right? Because I don't know about you, but I think the average person... Right? Right, exactly. I mean, I don't understand. Like, really? That's what it's going to come down to? Right? Meaning... they will acknowledge that every firstborn died, right? And only the firstborns. But 30 seconds, either they're going to say it wasn't God, or they're going to say it was God, but Moshe's a liar, right? However you want to take it. And Moshe didn't really know what God wanted because he was a shtickel, not precise. I mean, honestly, right? Meaning... right? Yeah, but yes, meaning... what? Right? But right, the major question here is, A, what are Chazal saying? But I think there's a bigger problem here, right? Which is, it's not just what are Chazal saying. You look at this and you need to ask yourself, what in God's name, in the Torah, right? In the Torah, indicated to them that this is a plausible read of the way that the Chartumim think, right? Or the Egyptians think. Meaning, this doesn't, you would hope this doesn't come out of nowhere, right?
Yeah, but you could say that, like there's a precedent for them thinking in this way.
Oh, so, okay.
You could say that the reason that
what are they thinking? Wait, let's see. What are they thinking? Let's tease out the ground. I want to just focus on this line. What is the lesson? What are they thinking here? So, yeah, okay. So tell me what they're thinking.
They believe in multiple gods, so maybe this guy was busy dealing with something else.
Uh-huh. Okay, good. Hold that thought. Okay, so look, I think you could take this in multiple levels. I think you could be very simplistic and say, what the Gemara is telling you is that the Egyptians are trying to, you know, find any excuse to deny what's going on, right? Is it irrational? Is it crazy? Yeah. Is there evidence in the story that the Egyptians are, you know, pulling at straws? Yeah, right? Right, meaning, yeah, they do, and yet they keep not sending them out, or they keep doing it, right? Meaning, okay, that's paro, in a chanami, right? So it's that simplistic level. You could say, listen, you don't want to give them any excuse, because people are people, they're going to do whatever they can, right? Fine. But let's say you wanted to push it farther. This is an analysis that I find very compelling from Rabbi David Foreman. I have always thought this is a very, very good read. What? Is it in a book? I think it is in the Exodus book. I think it's in the Mitzrayim book. I think it's in the Mitzrayim book. It's definitely in Aleph Beta on the Shurim, right? I think it might also... no, it is in the book. I take it back. It's definitely in the book. Yeah, no, it is in the book. I'm trying to think, because I know that the year I taught it... I taught this in Toronto, specifically the year the book came out, because they asked me to do a book review. And I did a book review of it, and I also did a few shiurim on it to show people some of the material that was in there. I find this very, very compelling. He turns to this Gemara and he says, okay, what the Gemara seems to be saying something different. If you want to read the Gemara more carefully, what is the Gemara saying? The Gemara is saying, and this comes back to something Josh said, okay? Let's say that in fact... all the firstborns died, right? Does the Gemara really think that the Mitzrayim are going to deny that there was any divine force here? Presumably not, right? That seems very unlikely. Right? But I form the notes that if you read carefully throughout the story, God consistently is trying to prove only God. The only God. Not just that he is a God, but that he is the one and only God. God with a capital G, not God with a lowercase g. And in order to do that, he needs to prove two things. One is that he has power. By proving that he has power, what does that prove? That he's a God. A God. But in order to prove that he's not just a God, but that he's the one and only God, he needs to do something else. What does he need to do? Very good. He needs to prove that he's precise. Why does he need to prove that he's precise, Josh? Exactly what you just said. Because if you're a powerful God, so then it might be, listen, he's a God in the pantheon. So he manages to kill you, but if he's 5 minutes late, maybe that's because he was delayed because the Egyptian god held him up, right? Right, exactly, right? Either he got up early, he overslept, or maybe he was fighting some other god, right? If he is a god, but not the only god, power he might have, but precision, right? Right, but precision, not necessarily, because maybe there'll be something that stops him, right? If he's just a god in the pantheon, you never know, right? If he's a humanoid god, right? Like all the Greek gods and the, right? So maybe he's sleeping.
The only problem is the final thing that he does say is about.
So the point is they cannot anticipate.
Now, no, because if you say, I will come within 5 minutes of midnight, and he comes within 5 minutes of midnight, then that's exactly what you said, right?
But if you say at midnight
and you come at 12:59, you didn't do what you said, right? If I say Shear is starting between 12:45 and 12:50, and I start anytime between 12:45 and 12:50, then I started on time, right?
Yeah.
But if I said 12:50 and I start at 12:49, I'm early, and I start at 12:51, I'm late, right?
So
Foreman says, okay, but where does he get this idea that that's what the Gemara is picking up on? Okay, so here's where I got you. I said pick up a chumash, okay? So this is, take this as an agadat this year and a little bit of an introduction to Shmot, okay? I could try to find my source sheet, but I'll just do it in the chumash. It's fine. Right? So if you look in a chumash, so let's start when Moshe first goes to Paro. Okay? Well, it happens twice, right? So Perek Hey Pasuk Aleph. Got it? This is the first time he goes. V'achar ba'u Moshe v'Aaron v'yomru el paro. Ko amar Adonai Elohei Yisrael shalach et ami v'achogu li b'amidbar. First things first. What does he say to him? Why? What does he call him? God. Yud. Okay, Vavke. What is Vavke? Right. What is he? So God says to Moshe, "Tell Paro, I am God, the Lord of the Jews. Send him out." Now, what is Yudke Vavke?
That is the seal of.
It's God. God's proper name, right? God.
Oh.
Right.
No.
I mean, yes. It's the seal of God. It's Hayahovah V'yeh. Right. That he's beyond time and space. Right. He's God. Right. God. Capital G. God. Right? What does Paro say? Maze, right? Vayom Paro, mi Adonai sheshma v'kolo shalachet ami. Lo yadati Adonai v'gam Yisrael lo tzayach. I don't know what you're talking about. So what does he respond? Vayom, what does Moshe say back? Vayomer Elohei Avrim Nikralin. Now he responds, what does he leave out? Yud Kei Vav Kei. Right? He doesn't call God God anymore. He says, Elohei Avrim, the God, lowercase, of the Jews. Right? So Rav Furman says, first things first, this is what happens. First, Moshe goes in and says, God, capital G, the one and only, Yud Kei Vav Kei. And Paro just says, what's Paro's response? Well, what are you, I'm sorry, what exactly are you talking about? This is nonsense. I don't even understand the words coming out of your mouth. Right? Because everything that's caught up in God, and as Eli correctly notes, Yud Kei Vav Kei isn't just any name of God. Right? It's the one that implies, it's the judge, no. It's mercy, but for this purpose, it's Elohim is judgment usually.
Yeah.
Yud Kei Vav Kei, right, is but for these purposes, right, Foreman says what's more important is that it's Hayah Hoveh V'Yehyeh. It's God is the eternal, right? Beyond time, beyond space, right? God, God. Paro doesn't say no.
He says
right?
Who?
He says who, what, where, when, what, I right, it's just like you see, it's just like I don't understand. Can you try this again? So Moshe says, okay. Let's work ourselves up there before I explain to you that God
within,
is God, capital G.
Within Paro's mindset, he is like, it's like how on the boat, Yonah addresses the sailors and he tells them he serves the God of,
Exactly. Exactly. Like when, exactly. When Yonah says, right, I serve.
In your context, you should, like,
you should understand, he's the God of the Jews. Right? He also happens to be the God of heaven and earth. But like, you know.
In Yonah's case, it's the Supreme God, but for your understanding, the God who's currently buffeting your ship on a storm.
Exactly.
And in Moshe's case, it's the Supreme God, but for your current understanding, the God who has come to judge the Hebrews you are enslaved.
Exactly. Right? So he says, okay, let's try this again. Let's start with what you can understand. He's a God. And if he doesn't sell us, if we don't go, pen yifkeinu v'deva or v'cheref, he's going to punish us. Right?
And it's going to be your loss.
Right, right. Now, that sounds very polytheistic, which is, listen, our God is going to punish us if we don't serve him. We're scared. So what does Paro say? Now you're talking my language, right?
And then he tells
and the answer is, shut up, go away, right? Meaning,
now you're talking my language, stop doing
that. Right, meaning it's, he's powerful, so am I. You're scared of him, you should be scared of me. Go back to work, right? Yeah, exactly. He's a god, I'm a god, Ra is a god, right? Okay, this Tefillah, I don't care, fine, your god is powerful, so am I. Wonderful. I'm so scared. Okay.
That one's only
the Midrash, but it's, okay. So now, but what you already see, he argues from the first argument with Paro, is that there's two levels, right? One is to convince Paro of God as the God of the Jews, lowercase. Right? But the end goal, what's the end goal?
God
is God, God. Right? God is God, God. Right? Okay? So he says, okay. Well, so here's where Rav Furman argues that to prove that God is a God, lowercase, all you need to prove is that he's powerful. Right? But in order to prove that he's God, God, right? And above the pantheon, right? You need to prove some other things, right? You need to show that he's not just powerful, but that he controls everything. Now, how are you going to do this? So, he notes, his argument is that one of the ways you're going to do that is by showing precision. Now, where does he get this idea that precision is important for proving that God is capital G, God, and not lowercase? Can you think, where does he get it?
It proves omniscience.
Good, but where, okay, but in the text, where does he get this idea? What, right, he's a nice svara, but where does he get the idea that this matters? So he says, proof one is the second maka, right? The second maka.
A frog or the crocodile.
Well, you know what? Before we even get there, let's start with the first one, fine? The first one, right? The first one, dumb. Okay, but this is not really the proof. But let's start for the second with Dom. Okay? So Dom. Right, this is Pereg Zion Pasuk. Pasuk Tedvav, right? Go down to the water, blah, 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 blah. And what does he say? Right, he turns it into water. Right, he turns the water into blood, rather. And then, what do the Vayasu Ken Chartumei Mitzrayim Balatehem Vechazak Leif Paro Velo Shama Leim Kasher Diber Hashem? Right? They do the same thing, and they don't, so he doesn't listen. Now, for us, right, I think a modern reader looks in this and says, well, why does the fact that he can recreate it mean that he's not going to listen? So a modern reader will say, because he'll say that Paro is, that Moshe is also doing it through sleight of hand. But what, in the ancient context, what was he probably doing?
He's proving that he too had
correct.
Divine ability.
You can do it, I can do it. Now yellow, right? I'm not saying you're not working for a god. I'm not saying you're not powerful, but who cares? Right? So am I, right? Fine. The second Makkah, though, is very weird. Okay? Second Makkah is Tzvardeya. And after, once the Makkah is in full force, what does Paro say to him? This is Perek Chet Pasuk Dalet. Vayikra Paro leMoshe Aharon, vayomer hatiru el Adonai, v'yaser hatzvardim imenu me'ami, v'shachar ha'am v'yizbichul Adonai. Get rid of them! Go and worship! Okay. And then Moshe says something very weird to Paro. What does he say?
When do you want them to
leave? When? Vayomer Moshe leFaro hitpoer alai lematay atir loch lavadech alam cholach kredet svardim imcham vedech arach biyor tisha'arna. Okay, when? When? Now, what should Paro reasonably have said?
Immediately.
Now! Right now! Right now!
Paro makes a challenge of it and says,
ah, very good. And what's the challenge? Tomorrow. Vayomer lemachar. Vayomer kidvercha leman teidaki en Adonai Eloheinu. And Moshe says, fine. And this will show you that no one is like God, our God. Why not?
Who can at a whim?
Ah, exactly. Because what's happening? He says, when? What is Paro Pli thinking? Okay, I don't know. Your God knew there was going to be some sort of whatever. Fine. You know, you're going to stop it now. Because maybe he's awake. You're in touch with him right now. He'll stop it, right? But maybe by tomorrow he'll lose control of the frogs. I don't know. Right? He'll be asleep. Right? Right? And Moshe says, no. Fine, I'll take the challenge. You want me to prove that our God is unique? Time and place. Right? Time and place? Deal. Exactly. Right? Absolute precision over the world. And then you get a second one. And he says two things. Moshe says two things to him. One, I'm going to tell you exactly when it's going to stop. And two, what else am I going to tell you? Do you notice the other thing he said that's also about precision? Not, I'm going to kill all the frogs.
Only in the river.
Very good. I'm going to kill the frogs, not in the river. I'm going to leave the frogs in the river. Right? And then you get something very weird. Pasuk Tet highlights exactly that. Vayas Adonai Kidvar Moshe Vayamutu Atzvardim in Abatim Umin Achatzerot Umin Asadot. That they die in the fields and in the houses, right? Exactly.
As from
right. Okay. Next Makkah is Kinim. Right? Now this is Midrashic. Kinim, right? What happens after Kinim? What are do the Chartumim say?
Etz
Be'elokim. Etz. What does Rashi say?
That they were trying to minimize it.
Right? So, no. So the Midrash says, Rashi doesn't quote the whole thing. No, he does say it. Right? Why? How did they know it was God?
Because
they can't deal with things that are smaller than a Se'orah. Right? They can do magic, but like there's a certain detail, right?
Smaller
right?
Than a barley
grain. Right? They already don't have control. Right? Continuing. Okay? Skip to
I want to
Arov. Again. When does he say it's going to get rid of Arov?
Tomorrow.
Right? And who does he say it's going to get rid of it from?
Only the land of Egypt.
Miparo, umi avadav, umi amo, lo nishar echad. There wasn't a single one left. Right? So watch the details. Amongst the Egyptians, there wasn't even one. Right? Because one would have, that would disprove it. Well, no. I mean, sometimes you have that deal, but not here. Right? But then Dever, you get it again. Because Dever, what happens?
Only the animals of the Egyptians.
Ah, very good. Right now he says, Moshe says, okay, Dever. But this time, you know what's going to be special about Dever? The Hifla Adon, this is Perek Ted Pasuk Dalet. The Hifla Adonai bin Mekinei Yisrael uvein Mekinei Mitzrayim, velo yamut mikol evnei Yisrael davar. There'll be a difference between the Egyptians and the Jews. Not a single Jewish animal will die. Okay? And again, it'll happen tomorrow. Fine. Now, Pasuk Zion, before looking at it, Paro is amazed by Dever. If you were to write the Pasuk that Paro was amazed by Dever, what would you write?
Paro was astounded by the contagion among the livestock.
Very good, right? He was shocked all the animals are dying. That's not what impresses him at all. What impresses him? Very good. Vayishlach Paro, v'hinei lo made me mekenei Yisrael
arechad. Not only is he astonished, he goes to check.
Correct. Right? What impresses him? Not that God kills all the animals. Okay, that happens. But that not a single Jewish animal died. That's impressive. Right? Not that God has the power to kill the animals, but that he didn't kill the Jewish ones. Right? You see, there's a pattern emerging here. That at some point, Paro becomes convinced, okay, I'm dealing with a lowercase God. Fine. Right? But what needs to be proved is not that he's powerful. Right? But he's precise. Right? Because he has absolute control over nature. Right? There aren't vying forces in nature. Right? And what is the Makkah B'Patish?
Makkah B'Patish is Makkah B'Chorah.
It's not Makkah B'Chorah.
It's Arba.
It's not Arba either.
It's Barad.
It's Barad. How do I know it's Barad?
Is it Barad or Arba that's number 8?
Arba is 8. But Barad is the Makkah B'Patish. How do I know Barad is the Makkah B'Patish? Because it's the first time that what does Paro do? He doesn't just say get rid of this death. What does he say? Ah, he confesses. He confesses. Right? And it's a story for another time why Arba is the turning point. Post-Barad is the turning point, right? And that's the story for another time. But the only time until after Makkah B'Chorot, right? Until the end, where Paro, at least for a moment, confesses that God is true, is Barad. Why? Why Barad? Of all the Makkot, why is Barad, right? Not the 6 before and not the 2 after until Makkah B'Chorot. Why Barad? Is that the one?
Any assumption of separation of forces is overridden.
Like, because
the fire and ice are working.
Very good, 100%. That's exactly what Foreman says. Because he says, listen, the fact that God is a lowercase g, God, fine, so hail, fire, yalla. But, in every pantheon in the ancient world, there's the fire god and there's the water god. And what do we know about the fire god and the water god? They don't like each other, right? They're opposites. That's the point, right? That's how the pantheon works, right? But if you could have the water god work with the fire god, oh, now what does that show? You're above the pantheon, right? So now you look at the pasuk in Barad, and he says, Vayhi barad ve'esh mitlakachat mitoch habarad kaved ma'od asher lo hayau kamo b'chol eretz Mitzrayim ha'azat elagoy. It was water, it was ice and fire.
And there was nothing like it at the time.
Exactly, and this time Paro says, Vayishlach Paro v'ekral Moshe Aaron v'yomer aleihem chatati ha'pa'am. And then what does he say? Magic words. Vishlach Paro Vayikra L'Moshe L'Aron Vayomar Lehem Chatati Apam Adonai Hatzadik Vani Vami Arishayim. Not Elohei HaIvrim. Right? Hashem is the Tzadik. Right? Wait. Why Hashem? Why did you suddenly believe? Why did you suddenly say Hashem? Right? Because God has just done something to show that he's above the pantheon, which is what we've been arguing the whole time. He's not just powerful, right? He's all powerful. He's above the idea of a pantheon. He's not a God in the pantheon of idolatrous idols. He's the God, right? So what Ray Furman argues is that consistently, if you actually pay attention to what's going on in the Psukim, right? It's not just that Paro wants to see power. Power, fine. Power proves that God is a lowercase g God. Scary, maybe, right? But it doesn't prove that God is Yudke Vavke, is the God beyond time, beyond space, beyond, right, above the pantheon, right? In order to do that, you need to show he has absolute mastery.
So is that why at the end of this one, like it's a double strengthening of the heart? Because that's how much it means after being able to...
Correct. Right. Well, Ray Furman also argues that this is maybe a partnership for another time, but he says this is why, until this point, the first seven makot, you get one of two things. Either Paro is machbid libo,
or God is
mechazek libo. Right? No. Right? God is, right? Now, what's the difference between mechazek and machbid?
Mechazek is he gains strength, machbid is just
hardens. Stubborn. Right, meaning. Lichazek is I give you the confidence to do what you want to do anyways, right? I'm giving you chizuk, right? Lachbid is to stop you from doing something, right? The first seven makot, either Paro is machbid his own heart, right? Paro stops himself, or God is mechazek libo, which means God, Paro really wants to say no. He's just a little bit scared, so God says, you want to say no? Fine, I'll help you say no, right? But after Paro actually says, Hashem HaTzadik Vanivam Yerishayim, God is the Tzadik. At that point, what does God say? Wait a second. You understand that I'm God and you're still rebelling against me? That's it. Right? Change of strategy. Right? And if you look at the beginning of Bo, it starts off with Bo al Paro, ki, ani, hichbad yet libo. And why? Because until now, what I've been trying to teach him, I've been trying to educate Paro that I'm God. Right? But after Barad, I did educate him he's God. And nevertheless, and therefore, I'm changing strategy. I don't care about proving that I'm God to him anymore. What do I care about? All I want to do is punish them. I just want to punish him. And now, who am I going to try to teach about God? I gave up on them. The Jews. And now you, I'll use them. Punish them and you can tell your children, but I give up on him. He understands that I'm actually God, capital G, and he still rebels? Kvalt. Goodbye. I don't care anymore. That's it. I'm taking away his free will. I'm punishing him. Yalla. Let's move on. Right? Now you are the target. Good luck. Okay. So now we come back to our Gemara. And our foreman says, well, once you notice that the story in Chumash is not just about God proving his power, but it's about proving that he really is above time, that he really is above the pantheon, right? And in order to do that, it's not just enough to have Makot, but to be very precise, to tomorrow, right? All Egyptians, no non-Jews, right? Frogs will survive, but only in the river, right? And that's part of showing that he's in control, right? He's not just powerful, but he is a different type of God. So then you come back to our Gemara. And our Gemara doesn't come out of nowhere. What's our Gemara saying? Yeah, in a Hanami. 5 minutes? 5 minutes could have ruined the whole thing. Because if the Hartman could look at it and say, you said midnight, it was 11:58, it was 12:02, they would say, okay, he's powerful, very powerful, I got it. But he didn't know the time. His alarm clock didn't go off. He's very powerful, but even the most powerful God needs a shluf, right? I don't know. He had a long day. He has a long day of plagues, right? This has been going on for a while, right? So he missed midnight. You know what? Yeah, okay. I mean, he's very powerful. He's very scary. but he doesn't know what time it is. Okay, I mean, okay. So he's God. He's a God. Okay, Yenacharami. But
why did Hashem make it known to Paro that he was the only one? What was the point of Paro knowing that?
Well, that seems to be the point for most of the Makot, as the Sfarno points out, right?
But why is that?
Because why shouldn't it be? What's your assumption? That God only tries to prove himself to Jews? No. God wants the world to know that there's a God. And what better way? And what better way? Yeah, what better way than to have the king of the known world, right, the most powerful king in the known world, come to recognize God, right? He eventually gives up, right? But the first seven Mako, that is the point. Right? So right, Foreman says, you know what the Pshat in this Haggadah says? It's not coming out of nowhere. Right? It's making a very, it's carefully read of the Psukim and is saying, yes. Right? Yes. No matter how powerful God is, if he lacked precision, right? If they could catch him in the slightest error, that would have been enough to undo the lessons that he taught them, right? Maybe they'd still think he's a God small g, but to teach him that he's a God capital G, right? That he's the one and only, that he's beyond time and space, that he's beyond the pantheon, that he's not subject to the foibles of human beings, like oversleeping, right?
Which tells you something about how far these Egyptians were willing to go.
Right. Now, obviously, part of it is to say, well, look how much the Egyptians are willing to do it. But the point is that, yeah, this is a big thing to teach.
How fascinating they were.
Right? Right, and it's a big deal, right? To teach people, right, and yeah, in the end of the day, they might be willing to concede that God is a God, even a super powerful God, right? But that next step to say, right, he has absolute control; he's beyond what we know of gods. That requires a precision to detail, right, to show that level of control. And so that's where Ray Foreman thinks this Gemara is coming from, right? That it's picking up on a series of patterns, right? In the psukim themselves about what it is that Moshe needs to prove in order to get the Egyptians to truly understand that there is a God and that God is, right, is unique, not in the way that they understand God's plural, but he is, right, he is Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei. Okay? So that's what I wanted to focus on this, because I wanted to, right, A, understand this, but also I wanted you to have an introduction, since we're going to Shmon anyways next week. It was a good enough time. We had skipped over this part of the Gemara last week. Okay, we have a few more minutes, so I wanted to just add a little bit then to what we talked about last week, going back to the David Gemara just in the few minutes that we have left, okay? Because I really don't have so much time, I'll just... Okay, this in general, if you like Agarata, this is a very helpful book. I love it very much. Rabbi Yitzi Blau wrote a book on Agarata called Fresh Fruit and Vintage Wine, The Ethics and Wisdom of the Agada. It's a playing on an Agarata about Agarata. There's an Agarata that describes Agarata as fresh fruit and vintage wine. So it's an Agarata. Exactly. It's an Agarata about Agarata. 15 minutes. At least 10 minutes, so whatever. It's 44, so 15 and a half minutes. Okay, we'll be very precise. Right? I don't know. But I'm not God, so I don't have to be that precise. So he knows, right? He's talking about our story. He notes our story. And he notes that Rochel Yaakov Weinberg in Lefrakim has an analysis of our Gemara that we didn't get to last week. And he says, what is the point of the whole Gemara? Remember the whole Gemara that David HaMelech actually says to God, am I not virtuous? All the other kings, they wake up late, but I learn all night, I get up in the morning, right? I paskin nida shayla zlatu shalabayla, right? My hands are covered in blood, right? So he says as follows. Ray Weinberg, I'll just read you Ray Blau's summary. He says, Ray Weinberg explains. Rechiel Yaakov Weinberg maintains that the entire Gemara testifies to David's sterling humility. As Rav Weinberg explains, the other kings who rise late might not do so solely out of laziness. Right? Until last week, we assumed they're lazy. But he said, there's another possibility. Indeed, they could argue that the responsibilities of their office place quite a heavy burden upon them, and therefore they need more rest. After a late-night emergency security meeting, who could fault the monarch for rising later than the farmers and shoemakers? Perhaps the delayed start of the monarch's day can be justified. Yet David does not rely upon this reasonable argument because it divides too sharply between the king and the commoner. He refuses to see his own work as more important than the work of others, and he insists on rising at a normal time. Thus, the first interpretation of David's virtue focuses on humility. Okay, so the first thing he adds to this is that, right, we assumed last week he's just saying everyone's lazy. But he said maybe they're not. Maybe they're just saying, listen, our schedule is less predictable.
He's not saying I get up before everybody else, is saying I get up at the same time as
everybody. Exactly. That's exactly it. Right? He's saying, I'm like everybody else. I'm not like the kings. Kings sometimes try to excuse themselves by saying, I was so busy, right? I had a meeting through the night. It's very nice. But put it this way. If I had a meeting through the night, right? And then I called her again and said, yeah, you know, I'm tired. Let someone else give share. That's not really how things work. Right? It's, why do you have a meeting all night? Or tough it out. Right? Normal people don't get to just do that. It's like, you don't want to come in? Take a vacation day. Right? It's not like, whatever, tomorrow, today I'll give afternoon seder. Let someone else take morning seder. And that's not how things work. Right? So, the fact that David doesn't take what could be a legitimate excuse. Okay, then he goes through Rav Kook. But we did that last week, okay? Then Michiel Yaakov Weinberg says the second thing. He says, according to Ray Weinberg, the second interpretation of David's virtue also indicates humility. Right? He says, one is expressed in the fact that he wakes up at the same time as everybody else, but the second is the fact that, despite the fact that kings normally address national issues, right, security, economic stability, and the like, which David does in this story, right? War, the Parnassa, what else does he do? Right, often kings...
He turns himself to learning.
And which type of learning? Dealing with the nidashailas of the average woman, tabihatu ishlabaila, right? Meaning kings sometimes really, really care about people, but the plight of the individual people is beneath them, right? I'll care about war, right? Like David does in the beginning. I'll care about the Parnassa of the whole country. But
not with individual street level shiloh.
Exactly. But here David's saying no, right? Someone needs me to pasca their need to shiloh, right? And then Ray Weinberg flips it and he says, it's more than that. The story proves more than just that David was willing to. What else does it prove?
He did.
He did, which shows what?
He followed through on his promises.
Very good, but more than that.
Followed through on his intentions.
Even more. That people actually believed it. Because they came to bring the shilas. It's one thing for someone to say, I'm willing to be there for the individual. It's another thing for a woman to show up with her underwear and say, I have a shilah. Is this stain of blood, right? Bigger or lesser? Is it David? That's, right? Just because David in theory is willing doesn't mean that he's managed to convince the average woman on the street to take a very personal, embarrassing shilah to the king and believe that he will actually be there for her. But it's not just that he was open in theory. It's that...
He's the accepted process.
Exactly. Right? That the... Right? Which shows you that, he said, if the monarch had insisted on always emphasizing the distance between himself and the masses, it's hard to imagine that women would feel comfortable asking him such questions. It must be that David's humility generated an atmosphere in which it seemed normal to ask him for help and in the laws of Nida. It's a very sharp point. Okay? Then he notes from the Itz Yosef, from Henoch Zundel of Salon, two other points. He says, for another point is that in Halacha, the Gemara in Kiddushin tells us that while everybody else in Halacha is allowed to be mochil their kavod, right? A father, if he wants to, is allowed to sell his son. You don't have to honor me, right? A Rebbe is allowed to say that. A Nasi is allowed to say that.
The Gemara king is not permitted to?
A king is not allowed to. Melech shemachal kvodo, ein kvodo machul. Right? That's how we paskin. A king... What?
He can't say...
He can't waive his honor. Right? He's not allowed to say... Right? He can't say, you don't have to show me honor. Right? Yeah, he's not allowed to say, you don't have to call me your royal highness. Right? You're allowed to call me... Whatever. Duvi. Right? I don't know, whatever. I don't know what you... Shloimi. Right?
whatever, right? Yoshi, going through all the kings here. And people in your family, I got that. I got it. Fine. Right? Fine. Right? You're allowed. You can't just do that, right? You can't say, hey, come sit on my throne for a fun day. Right? Get a selfie, right, on the throne. That's not how things work, right? He's not allowed to do that. Right? He's not allowed to do that. But that only highlights the fact that if he's not allowed to, even if he wants to, then what does it show? The fact that he paskins detailed nidah shailas? That no matter how intimate and how dirty, right, a halachic question is, it's never beneath your honor. Right, it's not beneath anyone. Right, meaning being involved in dirt, because if he's not allowed to waive his honor, then that means that paskins the shaila must not be beneath his honor. Right?
There's no Torah doesn't have a degree that you can say this is an elevated shaila, this is a low.
Exactly. Shaila. Right, exactly. Paskining, right, you can't say this shaila is beneath me. No, it's not. Right? The second point he notes, and this is something we already mentioned last week, is that he doesn't say, I'm here paskining shailas. He says, I'm trying to be matir isha labayla. Which, as we saw, shows you that at least in neither shailas, there is a bias towards kula. Right? Because David isn't trying to just paskin it, right? He says, I'm trying to find a head there. Lahatir isha labayla. Okay? And then the last point. You might still think, okay, by the end of this, David HaMelech might have an iota of arrogance. Because, okay, he's king, but he'll say, but I'm also a groisa Talmud Chacham. Right? I'm also such a serious Talmud Chacham. Look, everyone's asking me the shailas. So now the Gemara has to tell you, by the way, that's not true either. How does it do that? So if you remember...
It mentions how he'd be like shown up by...
Exactly. So Rav Weinberg says that's what the end of the Gemara is telling you. That he says to God, right, as soon as I would finish a shaila, I would say to Miffy Boshet, right, did I paskin properly, did I forbid it properly, right, and I was never embarrassed, right? The Gemara is telling you, not only was he willing to take on shailas that are intimate and you might think are degrading, but he wasn't even arrogant, he didn't, right, he didn't then say, oh, I'm the best nidah posek, right? Even within the degrading act of getting involved in the nitty-gritty of the nidah shailas, he went to Miffy Boshet and he said, am I right? Am I wrong? Right? Even as a Talmud Chacham, he didn't even take pride in being a Talmud Chacham. He did it because that was asked of him. Right?
That was
his calling. Needed. Right? But he went to Miffy Boshet. Right? Right, so therefore he says at this point the reader might still argue that David shows a bit of haughtiness in his bold halachic rulings. However, the conclusion of the Gemara indicates otherwise. This mighty king feels responsible to check the correctness of each ruling with his teacher. To convey how unusual this is, right, Weinberg tells a story about Emperor Nero. The source of this story is either Suetonius, Lives of the Caesars, Book 6, or Tacitus, Annals 16:4. Nero was a man of diverse talents, but had a poor singing voice. Nevertheless, precisely for this reason, he wanted to hear lavish praise for his singing. Despite his awareness of the truth, he wanted his courtiers to praise him for the beauty of the vocal music he offered. This made him much happier than the praise for genuine talent. This tale reflects the norm in royal arrogance. Our Gemara, on the other hand, shows us that David is not interested in stressing his greatness and divorcing himself from the common man. In his midnight routine, in his helping ordinary individuals, and in his confirming rulings with his teacher, we see the traits of a truly humble king. Okay, so those were just some ha'arot I wanted to add to last week, which were, right, the Shri Deishas, Rav Chilavak of Weinberg's additions, right, that the point of the story is to show the humility. Right, again, just to review, what was the humility? The unique humility was that, not as we said last week, it's not just that he wakes up early, but it's no, he wakes up
at the layman's hour.
Like the common man, right? And I don't say, look, I'm tired from all the important things I was doing last night.
He wakes up at the working man's hour, he answers the working woman's questions.
Exactly.
The common people bring their questions to him, and even then he turns to his mentors for advice.
Perfect, right? Exactly as Ellie said, right? What Rachel Langhorn was saying is that you see, he wakes up like a common man, he's willing to take their shailas, they have internalized the fact that he doesn't think this is beneath him, right? And therefore they ask him the shailas, right? And he doesn't even take pride in the fact that he's answering their shailas, and he's willing to ask his, right, his Rebbe for it. And then the last point that we just said, parenthetically, was that, from the HCO state, and don't think that this, right, the fact that a king who's not allowed to be mochel on his honor, is not allowed to waive his honor, is here, positing the shailas, shows you that nothing in Torah is ever degrading. Right, to be involved in a shaila, no matter how intimate, no matter how petty, no matter how small, must objectively not be a violation of your honor, because otherwise David wouldn't have been allowed to if he wanted to. Right? So therefore you learn
there's never any lowliness in Torah.
Exactly. Right. And that is some of the other things that you learn from the story. So that's just wrapping up what I wanted to do in the Zagaritas, both the Moshe side, which gives you an introduction to Shemot, and then just a few extra last minute comments on the David HaMelech side. Okay? Shkoyach, guys.